Welcome to the Special Sauce Podcast, real conversations about food and life, hosted by Serious Eats founder, Ed Levine.
Usually people come up to me on the street and I'm gracious and nice, and I see their face drop like they're visibly disappointed. Or I'll be at Fairway in the produce section and somebody will shove a phone in my face and be like, call my husband a fat fuck. I'm buying melon. I can't do that right now.
That is, of course, the brilliant and hilarious Susie Essman, who first appeared on Special Sauce in 2015. On this episode, Susie explains how her pandemic cooking increased her husband's ardor. She also gives us a sneak preview of the new season of Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's all coming up on Special Sauce.
This episode of Special Sauce is brought to you by the Serious Eaters at Togu, the knife subscription service. Personally, I have never felt confident sharpening my knives at home, so the idea of every 2 months someone sending me a chef's knife and a paring knife hand-sharpened by Togu co-owner and chef Cyrus Elias seemed like a fine one. Each time you receive your Togu knives, all you have to do is send back the ones you were using free of charge in a safe package Togu supplies. It's kind of like the old Netflix DVD by mail deliveries. Plus, you can cancel any time. So if you want to have sharp knives at the ready when you cook, and who doesn't, give TogUKnives.com a try. Mention Special Sauce and get your first 2 months free. Today, we are going to catch up with my old running partner, Susie Essman, comedian, actress, and of course, one of the stars of Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's a second helping of Susie Essman's Special Sauce, as I talked to her back in the day. Susie, 2015 to be exact, on an early episode. Not too many people know this, perhaps because not that many people watched it, but Susie and I once co-hosted a food television show, New York Eats, back on the short-lived Metro Channel. So that's how we got to know each other, which was really the best part of doing that show.
And then we found out we lived on the same block.
Exactly. And then we found out we lived on the same block. So welcome back to Special Sauce. I can't think of a better person to kick off our second helping series with. So, of course, I have to ask you, like, where were you and what did you have coming up when the pandemic struck?
Well, we had just purchased a new house in Rockland County because we wanted to be closer to you on the Upper West Side. We still have our apartment on the Upper West Side. And we moved in, the renovation and everything was done March 12th. So that's when we moved in, which was just the day that all the lockdown happened. Luckily, because we had been living in our one bedroom apartment, which was fine because we were just in Manhattan for 6 months, enjoying eating out every night and seeing all our friends. But in lockdown, I might have killed my husband if we were in one bathroom. And I know a lot of people did it. But luckily, we moved in just at lockdown and were very busy. We were lucky. We were very busy setting up the house. And I actually began cooking like a crazy woman in my brand new huge kitchen.
That's great, because you've always had an interest in cooking and you've always done some cooking. Did you really get to up your cooking game during the pandemic?
This is how I know my husband loves me, is that he tells everybody what a great cook I've become. I'm not that good. I'm okay. In the beginning of the pandemic, the thing that I found so difficult was I was foraging. You know, I was trying to get food. It was really hard. I'd wake up in the middle of the night to get a fresh direct delivery, you know, to get a time slot, 2 a.m., 3 a.m. Couldn't get a time slot for like 6 weeks. I was ordering from restaurant supply places like Baldor because I was paranoid about going into a store. I couldn't get a Whole Foods. I couldn't get a ShopRite. It was interesting because it made me realize how throughout history, humans, their main impetus in survival was foraging for food.
It's true. We were all returned to our roots.
I really was very, very aware of that. And then I finally got my fresh direct delivery time slot and I held on to it for dear life until we left in November to go to Los Angeles. But I was cooking every night. I was cooking. There was no takeout. There was none of that. And I've never done that in my life. You know, Ed, I don't have to tell you. I always lived on the Upper West Side, equidistant between Citarella Fairway and Zabar's. And I was single for so many years. So what was I cooking? I was getting prepared food, you know?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. But it must have wreaked havoc on your work schedule.
Well, luckily, I knew that we were coming back for season 11. I just got back from Los Angeles, where we just finished season 11 of Curb. And I don't really remember if we were supposed to start earlier. I think we were supposed to start earlier. It got pushed. I was home. I was just home cooking and cleaning. I didn't have a cleaning person either. I was cooking and cleaning nonstop.
Right.
I didn't work that whole time until I went to LA in November.
Wow. Yeah, because you couldn't do any stand-up gigs. I know you've done a bunch of corporate stand-up gigs and that kind of thing.
I did a couple of Zoom things. You can't do stand-up on Zoom. But I did a couple of speeches and things like that on Zoom. But no, I wasn't working. I was cooking and cleaning. I was my grandmother.
Did you miss it?
No. You know, in the summer, it was all kind of nice because we had a backyard and a pool and I was able to entertain outside. But once it started to get a little gloomy autumn, I was like, I got to get out of here. And then we were very lucky that we were in Los Angeles for 6 months where the weather was beautiful.
Yeah.
But also in lockdown last January, nothing was open, not even outdoor dining. So again, I was cooking and cleaning.
And it must have been okay for you. You're an established comedian and actress. What must it have done to comedians just starting out?
Yeah, that was really on my mind a lot because the whole thing for young comedians coming up is stage time. You got to get stage time. You can't do anything without stage time. And there was no stage time. So I read a lot and heard from other people. There was a lot of, you know, speakeasy kind of stuff going on and people on rooftops, people down under in strange kind of venues that were doing stand-up, but a lot of outdoor stuff. And outdoors is horrible for stand-up. Comedy clubs always have low ceilings, you know, so laughter hovers.
Yeah, and reverberates.
Exactly. Outdoors, it just goes up into the air like, ah! I hate doing stand-up outdoors. So people were doing that. They were making do. Those people lost a year of their lives.
Wow.
A year of their creative lives, not being able to get on stage. I'm sure a lot of people were writing, doing other projects, doing what they could. But if I did that in my second, third year of stand-up, it would have been devastating because everything was about getting on stage.
You've talked so much about that, how important that was starting out for you and for any comedian, because you have to know what works and what bombs, and there's no way to know it without doing it.
Exactly. When I was coming up, I would do literally 400 shows a year or more.
And be paid a total of $4,000 for them.
Correct. Larry David and I were talking about this the other day. We would get what they call cab fare, which was $7 a show. I used to take the crosstown bus back and forth to the east side. It was all about running around club to club to club. On Saturday nights, I would do 7-8 shows a night.
Wow.
And I'd make my rent, you know, because that was the night you'd make money, $50 a show at that point. All these people, all these Broadway actors and musical theater people, they've lost a year of their lives.
Yeah.
Hopefully they found other things to do, like writing and performing. But Zoom does not make it happen now.
Did you rethink any part of your life because of the pandemic, because of the time you had, the downtime? Were there any unexpected pleasures that came out of the pandemic?
There were a lot of unexpected pleasures. First of all, I didn't have to go to any funerals or any bat mitzvahs. They were all Zoomed and you could, like, you know, show up or not show up. That was a delight. Although Shiva, I missed a lot of Shivas because Shiva is food. With my husband, who is not Jewish, when we first got together and we went to our first Shiva together and I had to explain to him what it was. And he was like, well, what is it? I said, it's like a wake with rugala. So much food, like you've never seen this much food in your life.
That's great.
But I enjoyed not having to do social things that I didn't want to do. You had a built-in excuse to say, no, I can't meet you for dinner or lunch or whatever. I enjoyed not having to touch so many people, shaking hands. And people are so, you know, see you and hugging and kissing, and which is great, but you don't want to hug and kiss everybody that you see.
It's not something I've experienced firsthand, but when you're a well-known person, people must take liberties, and I'm not talking about in an angry or destructive way, but they feel they can touch you, right?
They do. They feel like you're theirs, you know, like they own you. For me, it's a little different because I could be really nasty to people and they think I'm in character. So that kind of works. You know what happens to me, Ed? Usually people come up to me on the street and they'll say something, you know, very lovely. And I'm gracious and nice. And I see their face drop like they're visibly disappointed that I'm not kind and nice to them. They want me to yell and scream. Or I'll be at Fairway in the produce section and somebody will shove a phone in my face and be like, call my husband a fat fuck, you know, something like that. I'm just like, you know what? I'm buying melon. I can't do that right now. Those kinds of things I actually enjoyed in the pandemic. I enjoyed the quiet of it in some ways and the time off I enjoyed.
Yeah.
On the other side of it, I missed seeing all my friends and I missed hugging my friends and I missed seeing my kids a lot and I, you know, all of that. So there were pluses and minuses.
And what about the kids? How does the pandemic change the dynamic between you and them and change their lives in general?
Well, luckily, they were all gainfully employed throughout the pandemic.
There are four, right?
There's four, yes. And they were all working throughout the pandemic. Juliana was laid off because she was an event planner. She got unemployment for a while, and then she landed an amazing job at City Harvest, which is more needed than ever. So she ended up changing her career in a positive way, and she's feeding New York. She's feeding people in New York, which is great. It's an amazing organization.
And then you said you have another daughter.
Cindy, my youngest, was always a foodie. Throughout high school, all she did was watch the Food Network. It used to drive me crazy. It's like, shut that off. I can't listen to it anymore. But she ended up being a producer. She started as a PA for Beat Bobby Flay and then worked her way up for a million different, you know, Beat Bobby Flay and Worst Cooks in America, and, you know, a million different shows that she's now a supervising producer on some, I don't know, baking show. She's moving on to another one. And she was working in post from home.
Nice.
She worked straight through the pandemic. I think there was 1 week that she didn't have work. So that was fantastic. And Kyle, the oldest daughter, she's a makeup artist and she was not working, but she started making, in the beginning, she started making masks. Nobody had masks. Remember, there was none of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So she would make thousands of masks a week on her sewing machine and then went back to school.
Wow.
Everybody was doing just fine. And then she got back to work soon after when production came back. And Andy, who lives in Los Angeles, he's a biomed guy and he works straight through from home. They were all employed, little bit of unemployment for a little while, but they were all luckily unemployed when they got that extra $600 a week.
Right. Do you want to talk to me about becoming a grandmother? That must be insanely exciting. My wife is so jealous, Susie. Vicky is dying for this experience.
It's a very sweet thing. We were in LA and not leaving the whole time. So, you know, we didn't see her, but she's only 3 months. So it was okay. You know, in the beginning, first couple of months, they're a little blobby.
Yeah. They all look like Lex Luthor.
Exactly. They look like old men, babies. It's so cute. So I'm Bubby.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe. My grandmother, by the way, was a horrible cook. So much so that when my father went into the army, he thought the food was good. You know, every morning she would make me French toast when I would stay at her house in the Bronx, because that was the only thing she knew how to make. And it was delicious because I just, you know, globbed on the maple syrup. That she didn't have the good kind. She had like the Mrs. Butterworth. And to me as a kid, that was like heaven. Anything else she cooked was disgusting.
Now, my grandmother was a great cook, but she was very, very poor growing up. Also lived in the Bronx, by the way, at 1415 Wythe Place. And she used to invite all four Levine boys over to lunch and make, you know, like really good latkes or blintzes or pot roast or whatever. But she thought the greatest luxury she could serve her grandchildren was canned fruit cocktail.
Oh, we used to get the canned fruit cocktail. I could smell it in that syrup with the maraschino cherry.
Yes, it was disgusting. And we used to literally put it in bags in our sport coat pockets. Because like, what are we going to do with all this? And she wouldn't serve the next course until it was all gone.
all gone. That is so funny. And she used to put cottage cheese in it also. My friend Lisa, her grandmother was also a horrible cook. And one year for Passover, she made a tzimis and nobody ate it. And we felt really bad about it. So we took the whole tray of tzimis and we flushed it down the toilet. Like we left like a quarter, you know, so she could think it was eaten. And she came into the kitchen afterwards. She was, everybody loved it. Look how they ate my tzimis. They loved it. They couldn't get and enough. Meanwhile, it was clogging the drains.
Explain to everyone what tzimis is.
It's prunes and all kinds of dried fruit, which I think they serve on Passover because everybody's so constipated from all the matzah.
We'll be back in a moment to conclude our conversation with Susie Essman.
So now I want to hear all about the 11th season of Curb. First of all, what was it like shooting in the pandemic?
It was challenging. Luckily, we only had to shut down, I think, for a day and a half through the entire season. We ended up shutting down in January because things were really severe in Los Angeles. They just made the decision to just shut down for the entire month for about 5-6 weeks. And that was a smart thing. Everybody's masks were tested daily. There's all kinds of zones. There's a zone A. It was scariest for us, the actors, because we were the only ones that had to remove our masks.
I have a friend who is a director who said that he will never, ever direct a film during a pandemic again because of what you just said. He used to have to go to a separate place on set to exchange masks.
Right. And there was hand washing stations and it was challenging. It was quite challenging. The last couple of months were fine because we were all vaxxed. I mean, we still had the mask, but I felt for the crew guys because they had to have their masks on all day, which is many times 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 hour days. And they were, you know, the tight KN95 ones. After a while, you kind of got used to it. But I felt very vulnerable when we were shooting scenes with a lot of extras, that thing that I didn't like. Mm-hmm. But we were tested every day and most of the crew was tested every day, if not 3 times a week. And it seemed to have worked. They're right now on their last week of shooting. They're done in 2 days. I finished 2 weeks ago, but it worked. We did it.
So 11 seasons. Is the process still the same? You know, you once told me there's no script. It's just an outline and away you go. Is that still the way it goes?
Still the way it goes. The only thing that's changed, I think, is that the outlines have gotten much more dense and complicated. Mm-hmm. We were talking about this the other day. In the first few seasons, there was usually 2 storylines. You know, Larry's the master of 2 storylines going on at the same time. And they were simpler and they were easier to shoot. They've gotten much more. Oh, God, I think each episode is 45 minutes at this point. It's not even 30 anymore. And HBO just lets Larry go and do whatever he wants. But the storylines have gotten so complex. So it's harder to shoot. The shoots are much more difficult than it used to be. In the beginning, it was just, you know, it was like, I got a barn, let's do a show. That's what it was like.
Right, right.
As we've gotten more successful and the budget's gotten bigger, it's gotten more complicated, but it's still just as much fun. We laugh all day long, all day long.
That's good. That leads to my next question. Does Larry change it up in any meaningful way from season to season to both keep himself and all of you interested?
Well, I think that he always tries not to repeat himself. And that's hard for him because we've done,
right,
not counting this season, we've done 100 Curbs. I don't know how many Seinfelds he wrote, the hundreds, way more than Curbs, because they did so many more. We only do 10 episodes a season. They probably did 24 to 26. So he tries not to repeat himself. That's his challenge. It's not a challenge for us. And then I think that all our relationships have evolved in many ways that we don't even talk about. We just do it. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, I'm just thinking of Cheryl. In the beginning, Cheryl and I weren't so close. I don't mean the actress, I mean the characters. And then over the years, it's become like us against them. Cheryl and I against Larry and Jeff. So things like that just start to evolve. And my relationship with Larry this season is interesting. There's certain things that go on this season, which I can't tell you, but where we're actually in cahoots with each other.
Wow, now that's radical. We should say that Cheryl Hines plays Larry's ex-wife.
Ex-wife, yes.
But she stayed in the show.
Correct.
And I believe she's taken up, has she taken up with?
Ted Danson.
With Ted Danson, yeah. So what about you? Do you bring new, fresh thinking? Do you feel compelled? Is Susie changing? Like, how do you approach each season? 11 seasons, a lot.
Yeah, and it's 11 seasons over 21 years. Season one was in 2000.
Wow.
So first of all, you know, I'm known for my cursing. I don't want to just say the same thing over and over again. I'm always trying to think of new ways to take down Jeff and Larry. You know, my daughter's married now. It just as my life has evolved, Sammy, my daughter on the show, who married Victor, Chet Hanks, as my life has evolved, so has Susie and Jeff's life, and their relationship has evolved. You know, Jeff's cheating on me again in season 11, as usual. And I always try to have a different attitude about that, depending on where I'm at in my life. I would never put up with that from my real husband, but Susie puts up with it from Jeff. And yeah, I do put a lot of time and effort into thinking about who she is and where she's at in her life and what she's doing and how I could evolve with the character and with the roles. As I said, you know, Larry and I are in cahoots this season. So that's a different thing. But Larry and Susie's relationship has evolved over the years. They're almost like siblings, you know, they'll have these blowout fights. And then the next day she'll see him. She'll be like, hey, Larry, you want to come to a dinner party?
Right, right.
Again, we've never spoken about it. It just has happened over the years that we've evolved this relationship where it's family. We're family. And no matter what he does to me, I'm going to not necessarily forgive him, but move on. He's still family.
And it also can add to your, when you do go off on him, you know, there's more to go off on.
That's right.
What are you most looking forward to returning to now that the pandemic seems to be receding?
Eating out. I miss eating out. I mean, we did a little bit in LA for a while. We were doing a little outdoor, you know, before we were vaxxed. And after we were vaccinated, we were eating outdoors way more.
Yeah.
I think we ate indoors once in the past year and 3 months, whatever it was. But I'm looking forward to going to getting back into the city, which I'll be there this week, and eating out and seeing my friends and hugging people. As much as I said, I was so happy not to have to hug people. There are certain people I love to hug, you know, and also just the idea of, Ed, how many times have I run into you on the street? You know,
it's true. We used to run into each other so much.
And that's my life on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. I walk down the street. I run into a million people I know because I've lived there since 1980. And I miss that. I miss that, my New York socialization. I really, really miss that a lot.
Yeah. So it's not just the restaurants. It's the whole urban culture that's become part of your life.
Yeah, I really, really miss it. And we were one of those people that abandoned Manhattan during the pandemic, but for good reason. I think we needed a little more space and we had it. We did occasionally stop by our apartment and whatever. And then we were in LA for 6 months, but I miss New York. I love street life in New York. It's one of the things I love more than anything.
Yeah.
And it's a visual feast. You know, in Los Angeles, we were living in Pacific Palisades. Everybody pretty much looks the same.
It's pretty vanilla.
It's pretty vanilla. And it was a nice place to spend the winter. And I was happy for it. But I miss the visual feast of Manhattan. I really, really do.
Yeah.
I miss my friends. I miss the ease of just life, which I think will feel different now that we're all vaccinated. I really do. So, and I urge every listener to get vaccinated. It's freedom.
It's true. So final two questions that I don't think we asked back in 2015. This is one I'm really looking forward to your answer. It's just been declared Susie Essman Day all over the world. What is happening on that day?
Oh, the first thing that comes to mind that I wish for is everybody is kind to one another. It sounds so sappy and Pollyanna, but I have always felt that kindness is completely underrated. Talking about what I miss about Manhattan, it's that. It's the interactions with people, strangers, where you have the ability to be kind to one another, whether it's letting somebody take the cab in front of you or being online at Zabar's or whatever it is. And that's why I think New York City is such an amazing place, because it's the great American experiment where we all live in this dense environment with every ethnicity imaginable.
Everyone takes the subway.
Exactly. And living in this small space together, and we all get along by and large. Yeah, there's random horrible acts of violence and things like that. But when you consider the numbers of people and the density, we all get along.
It's true.
That's what I miss so much, is experiencing the humanity. On Susie Espin Day, I would like there to be humanity and kindness. And then on the other side of the coin, everybody just telling everybody to go fuck themselves.
All right. So if Special Sauce could grant Susie Espin one superpower, what would it be?
Oh, well, let me think. I think that what I'd like the most is that bewitched twitching your nose and getting to someplace else, really. You know, I'd love to just, you know, you want to eat out in Italy one night and you're just there. You want to go, you know, especially for food. You want to go have some Indian. Well, not now, you don't want to go there, but whatever. The ability to just transport yourself.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what I don't want. I don't want to read people's minds. That is something I really don't want. I don't want to know what they're thinking. But the ability to just snap your fingers or twitch your nose or do the genie, you know, fold your arms and be someplace and experience cuisines from all over the world in a heartbeat, that would be fantastic.
That's awesome.
And then be able to just go home and sleep in your own bed.
That's great. Well, it's been great catching up with you, my friend. You are the perfect person to kick off our Special Sauce Second Helping series. We can't wait for the new season of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Susie, thank you so much.
It's going to be funny. And Ed, I can't wait to run into you in the street and give you a big hug.
That's it for this episode of Special Sauce. Thanks to my old running partner, Susie Espin, for coming back for seconds. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another brand new episode featuring the extraordinary politician, food justice warrior, and immigrant advocate, New York State Senator Jessica Ramos, and of course, another bit of Kenji wisdom. In the meantime, please stay safe and healthy, serious eaters. Get vaccinated and practice social distancing when necessary. And again, I urge you to do everything you can to support your local restaurants and the purveyors that supply them. The pandemic has wreaked havoc on the restaurants we all know and love. Though it may be abating, many restaurants are still suffering from the pandemic's devastating effects. If you can afford it, give to worthy organizations like No Kid Hungry or Feeding America, both of which combat the food insecurity an estimated 54 million Americans are grappling with during the pandemic. If you've enjoyed listening to Susie Espin and want more Special Sauce in your life, just subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Here's the best part. It's free. To help spread the word, you can even review Special Sauce on either Apple Podcasts or Podchaser. So long, serious eaters. See you next time.
Special Sauce is produced by John Kalish and Ed Levine. Associate producer, Morgan Flannery. Our theme music was composed by Charlie Morrow for Morrow Sound.